talking this morning about wisdom. I have no personal experience in this topic. I'm just saying some things I've heard some other wise people say. So James chapter 3, we're going to start in verse 13 when we get there. But I want you to, I want to tell you a story to start, and I don't know, maybe you've heard this before. Intelligence is not the same thing as wisdom. You might have heard the story of a minister, a Boy Scout, and Bill Gates were all traveling on a small airplane together. And the pilot came back to the cabin and he said, "The plane is going down." He said, "Now, not to worry, we're on autopilot, so right now we're okay, but pretty soon we're going to crash. Now, the really bad news is there's four of us and there's only three parachutes." And so the pilot said, I am a father of four and I really need to provide for my family." And so he took one of the parachutes and he jumped out the window. Bill Gates stood up and he said, "I should have one of the parachutes because I am the smartest man in the world and everyone needs me." And so he took one and he jumped. The minister turned to the Boy Scout and he said, "Young man, you have just started out in life, whereas I have had a rich life. So you take the remaining parachute and I will go down with a plane." The Boy Scout looked at the preacher and he said, "Relax, preacher. The smartest man in the world just picked up my backpack and jumped out of a plane." James makes kind of the same statement in a way. James chapter 3, verse 13. Let's read it together. "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder in every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes down from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace will reap a harvest of righteousness." James begins this section with a rhetorical question. Who is wise and understanding among you? It would be like if I said this morning, who is the best-looking person in this room? Nobody would raise their hand, or you would hope they wouldn't, right? And James is really calling out some people here in the audience. If you remember rhetorical questions, you probably got a lot of them when you were a kid. I know I did. They usually came from my mother after I had done something pretty bad, and she would say things like, "Do you want me to give you something to cry about?" Don't ever answer that question, okay? Don't ever just let that question lie. And what she means is, do you want me to give you something to cry about? Do you want me to, she doesn't want you to answer that. And so James says the same thing here. Who is wise and understanding among you? Why don't you raise your hand so we can talk about your wisdom? He's calling these people out. You see, because there were these people amongst this church here in Jerusalem that thought that they had some wisdom that came from someplace other than the Scriptures, other than the apostles' teaching, other than what Jesus had said. And they said, "Here's how we need to live our lives. Here are the things that we need to do." And James says, "Okay, you want to talk wisdom? Let's talk about wisdom." He says, "Who's the wise guy that's been stirring up all this trouble?" And he says this, he says, if you want to see what wisdom is, and it's the same thing that he says throughout his entire book. It's what we've already read now in four different sections of the text. He says this, if you want to see what real wisdom looks like, well then show it to me. Look at verse 13. He says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in humility that comes from wisdom." That phrase, "let them show it," it's really just one word. It's just show. And it's an imperative, which means it's a command. And so James is saying, show me. Show me, O great wise one, what your wisdom looks like. James has said this the entire way. He says, if you believe in God, then show me. If you love the poor, then show me. If you care about widows and orphans, then show me. If you say that you're committed to God, then show me. By the words that you say and the deeds that you do, if God is in you, James is saying, then he should be coming out of you. The evidence of your wisdom is not in the words that you speak or the lessons that you teach, but it's in the way that you live your life. It's the things that you do on Monday, not the sermons you preach on Sunday. I love that phrase, let them show it by their good life. James says there's a good life that we're to live as Christians, and that good life, that word good there, he really has two choices between two words. He could say agathos life, which would be a good, upright, moral life, or he could use the word kalos. And kalos means beautiful, beautiful. James chooses beautiful. He says the life that you live under the wisdom of God, following the path of Jesus Christ, should be a beautiful life. When I read that, I thought, all I could think of was, yeah, that's right, the old hymn, A Beautiful Life. I think it was number 9 in your hymnals, number 1 in your heart, right? And it was, each day I'll do a golden deed by helping those who are in need. And when it got to the greatest part in any song when I was a kid to hear the men go, life's evening sun, right? And I just thought there was going to come a time when I would be masculine and bearded enough to sing that part, right? Life's evening sun. And I still can't do it that well as the gentleman that could in that church, in that small church in South Texas. And here's the thing, they were living a beautiful life for God, a life that made me want to live like those men, that made me want to worship like them, that made me want to be husbands and fathers like they were. James says, you live a beautiful life when you follow the wisdom of God. And here's his whole thesis. James says this, true wisdom really only comes from one place, and that's God himself. So this morning, I want you to see if you can remember that. That number one, God is the source of wisdom. Let's look at the text again, verse 14. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom, in quotes, such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but it's earthly, it's unspiritual, it's demonic. Now, could James be any more clearer about the kind of wisdom that these people are professing? He says it's from the devil. We'll get to that word here in just a minute. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder in every evil practice. James says you just have to look at the results. If the results of your wisdom are bitterness and envy and disorder and chaos and factions and discord and jealousy and every evil practice, then it didn't come from God. I want to tell you this morning in our Bible class, our Superman class that Paul is teaching, we talked about different brands of Christianity that really look nothing like Jesus Christ. And here's the deal. I know that that's a false religion because it looks nothing like the beautiful life that Jesus lived. The beautiful life of Jesus did not go around picketing at funerals and calling people filthy names. The beautiful life of Jesus Christ did not murder in the name of God. The beautiful life of Jesus Christ didn't say that the life was really for a certain set or a certain kind or a certain color or a certain generation of people. The beautiful life of Jesus Christ says this is what our life should look like. That word demonic, oh, I love it. I love it when James gets real with people. You ever called somebody demonic? I haven't lately, you know, but if you call somebody demonic, I mean, that he's not leaving any wiggle room there, is he? There's two choices when you use the word demonic. You're either saying it's instigated by demons, that demons are actually making these things happen, or it's an action that emulates the demons. So either way, you pretty much lose. Door number one, door number two, not a good outcome, right? You say that somebody's actions are demonic or the lifestyle that they leave is demonic. It's either because the demons are pushing them and telling them to live this way or because you're just modeling your life after them. This is a principle that we see throughout Scripture. True wisdom, the beautiful life, is seen by the fruits that it produces. That's why in Matthew chapter 7, verse 17, Jesus says, likewise, every good tree, every beautiful tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. When I think about wisdom and fruits and trees, I immediately go back to the very beginning, right? Genesis chapter 3. And here is Eve, and she is being led astray by something that sounds like wisdom. Let's go back and read that together. Genesis chapter 3, if you want to turn there. If not, I'll be up here on the screen. The devil, the serpent, the tempter, the liar, right? He is giving Eve some information, some wisdom. He's dropping some wisdom on her. And he's hoping that she's going to make a decision based on some false information. So he says this to her: "You will certainly not die. For God knows that when you eat from it," and he's talking about this fruit from the tree, "your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Is the serpent somewhat correct? He's got some truth mixed in with his lies, doesn't he? And then Eve says this, or the scripture says this: "When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and look, also desirable for gaining what? Wisdom. She took some of it and ate it. She gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it." I have a real simple question for you this morning. Where did that wisdom come from? The wisdom that Eve heard, that hey, if you'll take a bite of this fruit, you're going to be like God. That wisdom came from the source of lies, the father of lies. It came from Satan. And so often in life, the wisdom that we base our life on is based on false information. Information that sounds good. Information like, you really need to look out for yourself before anybody else. Information like, the best thing that you can do to serve your family is to make a lot of money. Because if you make a lot of money, you can support them and you can retire well and your kids will go to a good college. That sounds like good wisdom. We tell our kids, we want you to be beautiful. We want you to work out. We want you to look good. We want you to be lean. We want you to look like this picture on a magazine. And it sounds like good advice. It sounds like they're going to be healthy and they're going to be popular and good things will come to them. But the truth is, it's all based on lies. Because the true source of wisdom comes from God. Daniel, I love the story of Daniel. Daniel is hundreds of miles away from his home country. He's hundreds of miles away from the source of wisdom. He's hundreds of miles away from people who would look at the fruit of his life and go, "Daniel, you really shouldn't be doing that." He's in Babylon, the center of lies, right? And the culture starts to creep in on Daniel's life. "Daniel, if you'll just eat these things, if you'll just live this way, if you'll just worship this way, things will go easy for you." And Daniel says, "You know what? I know the true source of wisdom. And my knee will bow to no one but God." And so here in Daniel chapter 5, verse 11, this is years down the line. After Daniel's beautiful life has been made evident to people who are his adversaries, this is what's said about Daniel. Listen to these words. Verse 11. "There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and" what? "Wisdom that was like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, diviners." By the way, I need to stop there for a minute. Those magicians, enchanters, astrologers, diviners, they had a kind of wisdom of their own. Verse 12. "He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel and he will tell you what the writing means." Now, Daniel was a keen individual. He was well-built and handsome. He was a good-looking guy. He was sharp. He knew his stuff. But there was an ability that Daniel had that could come from nowhere else, that could only come from God, and it was that ability to interpret dreams. Daniel's wisdom came from the true source, and so his life, his beautiful life, showed the fruit of that wisdom. Job 28:28. "And he said to the human race, 'The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding.'" In Romans 11:33, Paul writes, "Oh, the depths of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out." God is the source of wisdom, but humility is where we begin to find his wisdom. Humility is the beginning for us of wisdom. Look at verse 16, James 3. "For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find order, disorder, and every evil practice. James says, if you want to know what the soil is to grow evil, it's selfishness. So you want to look where evil kind of can take root and really sprout and grow the best? It's when you're selfish. I love this. I think this was Martin Luther who pointed out that you can't break commandments 2 through 10 without first breaking commandment 1. And the first commandment is what? That you should love the Lord your God. That there's one God and that He is the God above all other gods and there's not going to be any other gods. And every other commandment you can break, every other sin that you can make, it comes from first of all saying that there is another God and He is me. And so humility is our source. I love this phrase, bitter envy. It was the phrase that James had used earlier, and then he uses it again here in verse 16. I know you love the Greek, and so here it is. The Greek phrase is zelon pikron. Comes from the Greek root zelos. What word do you think we get from zelos? Congratulations, you're all Greek scholars, right? I just saved you $40,000. Yeah, that's right. Zealous is where we get the word from the root zelos. It seems pretty simple. To be zealous is usually a good thing. I think of somebody who is zealous for God as being a good thing. But if we're more zealous for ourselves than we are for God, then it leads to sin. In fact, Paul would say that at one time he was zealous for God in a way that led him to persecute the people of God. You know, turn over to Philippians 3. Verse 4 and verse 6 is where Paul is kind of giving his resume. He's saying, if you think that you have something to think highly of yourself about, you think you're wise, let me tell you about my wisdom. Let me give you my resume. And so Paul says, if someone else thinks that they have reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. And here they are, circumcised on the eighth day, of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. In regard to the law of Pharisee. Now listen to this. This is verse 6. As for zeal, persecuting the church. You say, Paul, that doesn't jibe. That's not right. If you're zealous for God, then why would you persecute the church? And Paul would tell you, it's because I was more zealous for me and then God than for God alone. As for righteousness based on the law, faultless. It's what Paul calls the Jewish nation out for. In Romans chapter 10, in verse 1, he says, brothers and sisters, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they might be saved. And he's about to tell the Israelites what stands between them and salvation, and it's selfishness. For I can testify about them that they are what? Zealous for God. He says they want to know God. They want to serve God. They want to love God. But their zeal is not based on knowledge. Since they did not know the righteousness of God and sought to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Paul says it, James says it, the way that we find wisdom is to first admit that He is God and we are not. If our zeal is not grounded by our humility, it becomes twisted and evil and bitter and selfish. It always turns inward. Great example of the role that humility plays in finding God's wisdom is found in the words of Abraham Lincoln. I'm sure you've heard these words before. I want to read them to you again this morning. It was a speech made in 1863, right in the middle of the Civil War. He says this, "We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We've been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. And we have vainly imagined that in the deceitfulness of our hearts that these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Listen to this. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we've become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace. Too proud to pray to God that made us." I can't say anything after reading that, but amen. He says the problem is that we think all the great things that have come to us in life have come to us by the sweat of our brow or by the bootstraps that we picked ourselves up by. He says, we become too proud to pray. Humility is where wisdom begins for us. Another prayer, this one written by Bob Russell. It has made the rounds of the email circuit for years now. But Bob Russell, the preacher at the Southeast Christian Church in Louisville, Kentucky, wrote this. It's sometimes attributed to other people. But I want you to hear his words this morning. This was the words that were read by a Kansas senator, a congressman. He says this in his prayer. We have lost our spiritual equilibrium and inverted our values, inverted them. We confess that we have ridiculed the absolute truth of your word and called it pluralism. We have worshipped other gods and called it multiculturalism. We have endorsed perversion and called it an alternative lifestyle. We've exploited the poor and called it the lottery. We have neglected the needy and called it self-preservation. We have rewarded laziness and called it welfare. We have killed our unborn and called it a choice. We have shot abortionists and called it justifiable. We've neglected to discipline our children and called it building self-esteem. We've abused power and called it political savvy. We have coveted our neighbor's possessions and called it ambition. We have polluted the air with profanity and pornography and called it freedom of expression. We have ridiculed the time-honored values of our forefathers and called it enlightenment. The wisdom of the world always sounds good to a point. James says, the proof is in what it produces. If all it produces is selfishness and envy and strife, then it is not from God. Humility is the beginning of wisdom because in humility we say there is one who is greater and smarter and wiser than us. God is the source. Humility is the beginning. But peace is the product. Peace is the product of wisdom. Let's look at our last section of this text together. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. What does that sound like to you? Remind you another section of text in the New Testament? When I read that, I couldn't help but think of the fruits of the Spirit. Sound kind of similar? I have to tell you, this past week, I was blown away, that my three-year-old, Jackson, I'm bragging right now, that's okay. He can tell you the fruits of the Spirit when he wants to, okay? If you put him on the spot this morning, he will likely ignore you and walk away. He does that a lot. But I was blown away that his little three-year-old mind can rattle off the fruits of the Spirit. And that is, I'd say thank you to Joe Leachman if he were here, but he's back doing kids' praise where Jackson learned that. And so James is saying, kind of like Paul says in Galatians, in Galatians 5, he says there's something that is produced out of the wisdom of God, what Paul would call the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit of God. And it produces, finally in verse 18, peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. Let's look at the list here. He begins with pure. But the wisdom from above is first pure. The word refers to something that's free from stain, free from toxins. It's unspoiled. The next seven words seem to illustrate what pure and toxin-free Christians look like, what a beautiful life would be. They're peaceable. Rather than creating parties, they seek to bring people together. They pursue peace. They are gentle. That is, they are kind, willing to yield, willing to bend a little. They're open to reason. The phrase literally means easily persuaded and refers to a church that's willing to hear alternative viewpoints on things that don't touch on core convictions. This is they are impartial, a word that means without prejudice. This is a church that doesn't stereotype, caricature, or base conclusion on someone's color or background. They are sincere, literally without hypocrisy. This is a church that doesn't just put on pretense, that doesn't just focus on what looks good or sounds good. And finally, he says, they are full of mercy and good fruits. James defines mercy earlier in chapter 2 as a willingness to demonstrate love toward other people in very concrete ways. James never settles, never relies on just an idea. It's always about function for James. It's about how these things live out in the real world. And so James says that if the wisdom of God is in you, it will produce peace. James is saying that you can tell a church, like you can tell a church really gets it, really gets what it believes, really gets the wisdom and the understanding it claims to possess, gets translated not into criticism of other people, but into compassion, not into stereotyping, but into serving, not into meanness, but into mercy, not into toughness, but into tenderness, not into drawing lines, but into extending hands. One way of summarizing this is just simply to say they live at peace. And that word peace, that's kind of a loaded word. We're standing in the office there with Justin Cherry. And I'm totally outing Justin. I didn't even call him or email him to tell you this story on him. He's going to forgive me. He's a good man. He has on his forearm a tattoo. I know. Just hang on, okay? Don't judge him too early. And it has some Hebrew letters on there, which he has gone actually to school to know that it does say what it says. And it says on his arm, peace. And he says, but I need to explain this to you. It's not the peace that you think of when you think of peace. The peace that's on my arm is the peace that's called shalom. And it's a peace that exists only when God gives it. It's a peace that comes to us only when God grants it. It's the peace that exists in heaven, where we live at peace with God, in unity with God, where we're one with God. It's a oneness. And so when the Hebrews greet each other, they would say shalom. And shalom is not hello. It's not aloha. It's not hola. It's not what's up. Peace to them is may the peace of God be upon you. May you reside and live with God the way we will live with Him in heaven. That's pretty heavy. And James says that's the kind of shalom that our lives should be looking towards. I'll close with this story. It's the story of William Booth, who was the founder of the Salvation Army. William Booth and his associates, they were bitterly attacked in the press. They were being accused of all kinds of things. In fact, it was other religious leaders and government leaders that were accusing the Salvation Army of doing terrible things. None of them were true. William Booth had a son named Bramwell, and Bramwell came up to him, and he showed his father the latest headline, the latest article in the newspaper. And William Booth said this, Bramwell, 50 years from now, it will matter very little indeed how these people treated us. It will matter a great deal more how we treated the work of God. William Booth says, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what false things people say about us as long as we've been true to the wisdom of God. Wisdom comes from only one place. It comes from God Himself. It begins in our hearts when we humbly profess that He is God and we are not. And then finally, it produces the product of peace, of shalom, of oneness with God, where He reigns in our hearts and in our lives. I want to extend to you an opportunity this morning to take hold of that peace. You know, the idea of being humble, of having humility, is not a one-time decision. It's a decision that we'll wrestle with every day of our life. We will wake up tomorrow and want to put ourselves on the throne of our hearts. It is only natural. And so I want to encourage you this week, this morning, to make that decision again, to live a beautiful life for God, to walk in His wisdom and not the wisdom of the world. Because the wisdom of the world, it sounds pretty reasonable. It sounds pretty good. But the wisdom of God endures forever. The wisdom of God leads us to a place where He reigns eternally. Let's pray together.